Chapter 15. To the Ice. I awoke. Up until now, it had been strange, unbelievable, to wake up inside a dim cone of warmth, and to hear my reason tell me that it was a tent, that I lay in it alive, that I was not still in Pullifen Farm. This time there was no strangeness in my waking, but a grateful sense of peace. Sitting up, I yawned and tried to comb back my matted hair with my fingers. I looked at Estevan, stretched out sound asleep on his sleeping bag a couple of feet from me. He wore nothing but his breeches. He was hot. The dark, secret face was laid bare to the light, to my gaze. Estevan, asleep, looked a little stupid, like everyone asleep. A round, strong face, relaxed and remote, small drops of sweat on the upper lip and over the heavy eyebrows. I remember how he had stood sweating on the parade stand in Erenrong, in panoply of rank and sunlight. I saw him now defenseless and half-naked in a colder light, and for the first time saw him as he was. He woke late and was slow in waking. At last he staggered up, yawning, pulled on his shirt, stuck his head out to judge the weather, and then asked me if I wanted a cup of Orsch. When he found that I had crawled about and brewed up a pot of the stuff with the water he had left in a pan as ice on the stove last night, he accepted a cup, thanked me stiffly, and sat down to drink it. "Where do we go from here, Estevan?" "It depends on where you want to go, Mr. I, and on what kind of travel you can manage." "What's the quickest way out of Orgrun?" "West, to the coast, 30 miles or so." "What then?" "The harbors will be freezing, or already frozen, here. In any case, no ships go out far in winter. It would be a matter of waiting and hiding somewhere until next spring, when the great traders go out to Sith and Perenter. None will be going to Carhide if the trade embargoes continue. We might work our passage on a trader. I am out of money, unfortunately." "Is there any alternative?" "Carhide, overland." "How far is it? 1,000 miles? "Yes, by road. But we couldn't go on the roads. We wouldn't get past the first inspector. Our only way would be north, through the mountains, east across the Gobrin, and down to the border at Guthan Bay."
"Across the Gobrin, the ice sheet, you mean?" He nodded.
"It's not possible in winter, is it?" "I think so, with luck, as in all winter journeys. In one respect, a glacier crossing is better in winter. The good weather, you know, tends to stay over the great glaciers where the ice reflects the heat of the sun. The storms are pushed out to the periphery. Therefore, the legends about the place inside the blizzard. That might be in our favor. Little else."
"Then you seriously think..."
"There would have been no point taking you from Pullifen Farm if I did not." He was still stiff, sore, grim. Last night's conversation had shaken us both. "And I take it that you consider the ice crossing a better risk than waiting about till spring for a sea crossing." He nodded. "Solitude," he explained, laconic. I thought it over for a while. "I hope you've taken my inadequacies into account. I'm not as cold-proof as you. Nowhere near it. I'm no expert on skis. I'm not in good shape, though much improved from a few days ago." Again he nodded. "I think we might make it," he said, with that complete simplicity I had so long taken for irony. "All right." He glanced at me and drank down his cup of tea. Tea, it might as well be called. Brewed from roasted perm grain, Orsch is a brown, sweet-sour drink, strong in vitamins A and C, sugar, and a pleasant stimulant related to lobelin. Where there is no beer on winter, there is Orsch. Where there is neither beer nor Orsch, there are no people. "It will be hard," he said, setting down his cup. "Very hard. Without luck, we will not make it. I'd rather die up on the ice than in that cesspool you got me out of." He cut off a chunk of dried bread apple, offered me a slice, and sat meditatively chewing. "We'll need more food," he said. "What happens if we do make it to Carhide? To you, I mean. You're still proscribed." He turned his dark otter's glance on me. Yes, I suppose I'd stay on this side. And when they found you'd help their prisoner escape, they needn't find it. He smiled bleak and said, First we have to cross the ice. I broke out, Listen, Estevan, will you forgive me what I said yesterday?
Monsieur.
He stood up, still chewing, put on his yeb, coat, and boots, and slipped otter-like out the self-sealing valved door. From outside, he stuck his head back in. I may be late or gone overnight. Can you manage here?
Yes.
All right. With that, he was off. I never knew a person who reacted so wholly and rapidly to a changed situation as Estevan. I was recovering and willing to go. He was out of Thongan. The instant that was all clear, he was off. He was never rash or hurried, but he was always ready. It was the secret, no doubt, of the extraordinary political career he threw away for my sake. It was also the explanation of his belief in me and devotion to my mission. When I came, he was ready. Nobody else on Winter was. Yet he considered himself a slow man, poor in emergencies. Once he told me that being so slow-thinking, he had to guide his acts by a general intuition of which way his luck was running, and that this intuition rarely failed him. He said it seriously. It may have been true. The foretellers of the fastnesses are not the only people on Winter who can see ahead. They have tamed and trained the hunch, but not increased its certainty. In this matter, the Omeshta also have a point. The gift is perhaps not strictly or simply one of foretelling, but is rather the power of seeing, if only for a flash, everything at once. Seeing whole. I kept the little heater stove at its hottest setting while Estevan was gone, and so got warm clear through for the first time in how long? I thought it must be Thurn by now, the first month of winter, and of a new year one, but I had lost count in Pelophon. The stove was one of those excellent and economical devices perfected by the Gathenians in their millennial effort to outwit cold. Only the use of a fusion pack as power source could improve it. Its bionic-powered battery was good for 14 months' continuous use. Its heat output was intense. It was stove, heater, and lantern all in one, and it weighed about 4 pounds. We would never have got 50 miles without it. It must have cost a good deal of Estevan's money, that money I had loftily handed over to him in Mishnori. The tent, which was made of plastics developed for weather resistance and designed to cope with at least some of the inside water condensation that is the plague of tents in cold weather. The pessary fur sleeping bags, the clothes, skis, sledge, food supplies, everything was of the finest make and kind, lightweight, durable, expensive. If he had gone to get more food, what was he going to get it with? He did not return till nightfall next day. I had gone out several times on snowshoes, gathering strength, and getting practice by waddling around the slopes of the snowy vale that hid our tent. I was competent on skis, but not much good on snowshoes. I dared not go far over the hilltops, lest I lose my backtrack. It was wild country, steep, full of creeks and ravines, rising fast to the cloud-haunted mountains eastward. I had time to wonder what I would do in this forsaken place if Estevan did not come back. He came swooping over the dusky hill. He was a magnificent skier, and stopped beside me, dirty and tired and heavy-laden. He had on his back a huge sooty sack stuffed full of bundles. Father Christmas, who pops down the chimneys of old earth. The bundles contained caddick germ, dried bread apple, tea, and slabs of the hard, red, earthy-tasting sugar that Gathenians refine from one of their tubers. How did you get all this?
Stole it, said the one-time Prime Minister of Karhide, holding his hands over the stove, which he had not yet turned down.
Even he was cold. In Turf, close thing. That was all I ever learned. He was not proud of his exploit, and not able to laugh at it. Stealing is a vile crime on Winter. Indeed, the only man more despised than the thief is the suicide. We'll use up this stuff first, he said, as I set a pan of snow on the stove to melt. It's heavy. Most of the food he had laid in previously was hyperfood rations, a fortified, dehydrated, compressed, cubed mixture of high-energy foods. The Argotan name for it is Gitchi-Michi, and that's what we called it, though of course we spoke Karhaidish together. We had enough of it to last us 60 days at the minimal standard ration, a pound a day apiece. After he had washed up and eaten, Estevan sat a long time by the stove that night, figuring out precisely what we had and how and when we must use it. We had no scales, and he had to estimate, using a pound box of Gitchi-Michi as standard. He knew, as do many Athenians, the caloric and nutritive value of each food. He knew his own requirements under various conditions and how to estimate mine pretty closely. Such knowledge has high survival value on winter. When at last he had got our rations planned out, he rolled over onto his bag and went to sleep. During the night, I heard him talking numbers out of his dreams, weights, days, distances. We had, very roughly, 800 miles to go. The first 100 would be north or northeast, going through the forest and across the northernmost spurs of the Sembenshin Range to the Great Glacier, the ice sheet that covers the double-lobed great continent everywhere north of the 45th parallel, and in places dips down almost to the 35th. One of these southward extensions is in the region of the Fire Hills, the last peaks of the Sembenshins, and that region was our first goal. There, among the mountains, Estevan reasoned, we should be able to get onto the surface of the ice sheet, either descending onto it from a mountain slope or climbing up to it on the slope of one of its effluent glaciers. Thereafter, we would travel on the ice itself, eastward, for some 600 miles. Where its edge trends north again, near the Bay of Guthan, we would come down off it and cut southeast a last 50 or 100 miles across the Senche Bogs, which by then should be 10 or 20 feet deep in the snow, to the Karhaidish border. This route kept us clear from start to finish of inhabited or inhabitable country. We would not be meeting any inspectors. This was indubitably of the first importance. I had no papers, and Estevan said that his wouldn't hold up under any further forgeries. In any case, though I could pass for a Gathenian when no one expected anything else, I was not disguisable to an eye looking for me. In this respect, then, the way Estevan proposed for us was highly practical. In all other respects, it seemed perfectly insane. I kept my opinion to myself, for I fully meant what I'd said about preferring to die escaping if it came down to a choice of deaths. Estevan, however, was still exploring alternatives. Next day, which we spent in loading and packing the sledge very carefully, he said, "If you raise the starship, when might it come?" "Anywhere between 8 days and a half month, depending on where it is in its solar orbit relative to Gethin. It might be on the other side of the sun." "No sooner?" "No sooner. The Nathal motive can't be used within a solar system. The ship can come in only on rocket drive, which puts her at least 8 days away." "Why?" He tugged a cord tight and knotted it before he answered, "I was considering the wisdom of trying to ask aid from your world, as mine seems unhelpful. There's a radio beacon in Turf." "How powerful?" "Not very. The nearest big transmitter would be in Kuhumi, about 400 miles south of here." "Kuhumi's a big town, isn't it? 250,000 souls." "We'd have to get the use of the radio transmitter somehow, then hide out for at least 8 days with the SARF alerted." "Not much chance." He nodded. I lugged the last sack of Kadic germ out of the tent, fitted it into its niche in the sledge load, and said, "If I had called the ship that night in Mishnori, the night you told me to, the night I was arrested..." But Absol had my ansible. Still has it, I suppose. "Can he use it?" "No, not even by chance, fiddling about. The coordinate settings are extremely complex. But if only I'd used it..." "If only I'd known the game was already over that day," he said, and smiled. He was not one for regrets. "You did, I think, but I didn't believe you." When the sledge was loaded, he insisted that we spend the rest of the day doing nothing, storing energy. He lay in the tent writing in a little notebook in his small, rapid, vertical cursive Karhaidish hand, the account that appears as the previous chapter. He hadn't been able to keep up his journal during the past month, and that annoyed him. He was pretty methodical about that journal. Its writing was, I think, both an obligation to and a link with his family, the Hearth of Esther. I learned that later, however. At the time, I didn't know what he was writing, and I sat waxing skis or doing nothing. I whistled a dance tune and stopped myself in the middle. We only had one tent, and if we were going to share it without driving each other mad, a certain amount of self-restraint, of manners, was evidently required. Estevan had looked up at my whistling all right, but not with irritation. He looked at me rather dreamily and said, "I wish I'd known about your ship last year. Why did they send you onto this world alone?" The first envoy to a world always comes alone. One alien is a curiosity. Two are an invasion. The first envoy's life is held cheap. No, the Ecumen really doesn't hold anybody's life cheap. So it follows, better to put one life in danger than 2 or 20. It's also very expensive and time-consuming, you know, shipping people over the big jumps. Anyhow, I asked for the job. "In danger, honor," he said, evidently a proverb, for he added mildly, "We'll be full of honor when we reach Carhide." When he spoke, I found myself believing that we would in fact reach Carhide, across 800 miles of mountain, ravine, crevasse, volcano, glacier, ice sheet, frozen bog or frozen bay, all desolate, shelterless, and lifeless, in the storms of midwinter, in the middle of an ice age. He sat writing up his records with the same obdurate, patient thoroughness I had seen in a mad king up on the scaffolding, mortaring a joint, and said, "When we reach Carhide." His "when" was no mere dateless hope, either. He intended to reach Carhide by the fourth day of the fourth month of winter, Ahad Anur. We were to start tomorrow, the 13th of the first month, Tormenbad Thern. Our rations, as well as he could calculate, might be stretched at farthest to 3 Gathenian months, 78 days. So we would go 12 miles a day for 70 days and get to Carhide on Ahad Anur. That was all settled. No more to do now but get a good sleep. We set off at dawn, on snowshoes, in a thin, windless snowfall. The surface over the hills was Bessa, soft and still unpacked, what Terran skiers, I think, call wild snow. The sledge was heavily loaded. Estevan guessed the total weight to pull at something over 300 pounds. It was hard to pull in the fluffy snow, though it was as handy as a well-designed little boat. The runners were marvels, coated with a polymer that cut resistance almost to nothing. But of course that was no good when the whole thing was stuck in a drift. On such a surface, and going up and down slopes and gullies, we found it best to go one in harness pulling and one behind pushing. The snow fell fine and mild all day long. We stopped twice for a bite of food. In all the vast hilly country there was no sound. We went on, and all of a sudden it was twilight. We halted in a valley very like the one we had left that morning, a dell among white-humped hills. I was so tired I staggered, yet I could not believe the day was over. We had covered by the sledge meter almost 15 miles. If we could go that well in soft snow, fully loaded, through a steep country whose hills and valleys all ran athwart our way, then surely we could do better up on the ice, with hard snow, a level way, and a load always lighter. My trust in Estevan had been more willed than spontaneous. Now I believed him completely. We would be in Carhide in 70 days. "You've traveled like this before," I asked him. "Sledged? Often. Long hauls? I went a couple of 100 miles on the Kerm ice one autumn years ago." The lower end of Kermland, the mountainous southernmost peninsula of the Carhide semi-continent, is, like the north, glaciated. Humanity on the great continent of Gethen lives in a strip of land between two white walls. A further decrease of 8% in solar radiation, they calculate, would bring the walls creeping together. There would be no men, no land, only ice. What for? Curiosity? Adventure? He hesitated and smiled slightly. The augmentation of the complexity and intensity of the field of intelligent life, he said, quoting one of my ecumenical quotations. Ah, you were consciously extending the evolutionary tendency inherent in being, one manifestation of which is exploration. We were both well pleased with ourselves, sitting in the warm tent, drinking hot tea, and waiting for the caddic germ porridge to boil. That's it, he said, six of us, all very young, my brother and I from Esther, four of our friends from Stock. There was no purpose for the journey. We wanted to see Terramander, a mountain that stands up out of the ice down there. Not many people have seen it from the land. The porridge was ready, a different matter from the stiff bran mush of Pelican Farm. It tasted like the roast chestnuts of Terra, and burned the mouth splendidly. Warm, though benevolent, I said, "The best food I've eaten on Gethin has always been in your company, Estevan." "Not at that banquet in Mishnori." "No, that's true. You hate Orgrin, don't you?" "Very few are got to know how to cook." "Hate Orgrin? No, how should I? How does one hate a country, a loved one? Tibby talks about it. I lack the trick of it. I know people, I know towns, farms, hills, and rivers and rocks. I know how the sun at sunset in autumn falls on the side of a certain plowland in the hills. But what is the sense of giving a boundary to all of that, of giving it a name and ceasing to love where the name ceases to apply? What is love of one's country? Is it hate of one's uncountry? Then it's not a good thing. Is it simply self-love? That's a good thing, but one mustn't make a virtue of it or a profession. Is it simply self-love? That's a good thing, but one mustn't make a virtue of it or a profession. Insofar as I love life, I love the hills of the domain of Esther. But that sort of love does not have a boundary line of hate. And beyond that, I am ignorant, I hope. Ignorant in the Handara sense, to ignore the abstraction, to hold fast to the thing. There was in this attitude something feminine, a refusal of the abstract, the ideal, a submissiveness to the given, which rather displeased me. Yet he added, scrupulous, "A man who doesn't detest a bad government is a fool, and if there were such a thing as a good government on earth, it would be a great joy to serve it." There we understood each other. "I know something of that joy," I said. "Yes, so I judged." I rinsed our bowls with hot water and dumped the rinsings out the valve door of the tent. It was blind dark outside. Snow fell fine and thin, just visible in the oval, dim shaft of light from the valve. Sealed again in the dry warmth of the tent, we laid out our bags. He said something, "Give the bowls to me, Mr. I," or some such remark, and I said, "Is it going to be Mr., clear across the Gobrin ice?" He looked up and laughed. "I don't know what to call you. My name is Genli I." "I know. You use my land name." "I don't know what to call you either." "Harth." "Then I'm I. Who uses first names?" "Harth brothers or friends," he said, and saying it was remote, out of reach. 2 feet from me, in a tent 8 feet across. No answer to that. What is more arrogant than honesty? Cooled, I climbed into my fur bag. "Good night, I," said the alien, and the other alien said, "Good night, Harth." A friend. What is a friend in a world where any friend may be a lover at a new phase of the moon? Not I, locked in my virility. No friend to Theram Harth, or any other of his race. Neither man nor woman, neither and both. Cyclic, lunar, metamorphosing under the hand's touch. Changelings in the human cradle, they were no flesh of mine, no friends, no love between us. We slept. I woke once and heard the snow ticking thick and soft on the tent. Estevan was up at dawn getting breakfast. The day broke bright. We loaded up and were off as the sun gilded the tops of the scrubby bushes rimming the dell, Estevan pulling in harness, and I as pusher and rudder at the stern. The snow was beginning to get a crust on it. On clear downslopes, we went like a dog team at a run. That day, we skirted and then entered the forest that borders Pelophon Farm, the forest of dwarfs, thick-set, knurl-limbed, ice-bearded Thor trees. We dared not use the main road north, but logging roads lent their direction to us sometimes for a while, and as the forest was kept clear of fallen trees and undergrowth, we got on well. Once we were in Tauranpath, there were fewer ravines or steep ridges. The sledge meter at evening said 20 miles for the day's run, and we were less tired than the night before. One palliative of winter on winter is that the days stay light. The planet has a few degrees of tilt to the plane of the ecliptic, not enough to make an appreciable seasonal difference in low latitudes. Season is not a hemispheric effect, but a global one, a result of the elliptoid orbit. At the far and slow-moving end of the orbit, approaching and departing from aphelion, there is just enough loss of solar radiation to disturb the already uneasy weather patterns, to chill down what is cold already, and turn the wet gray summer into white violent winter. Drier than the rest of the year, winter might be pleasanter if it were not for the cold. The sun, when you see it, shines high. There is no slow bleeding away of light into the darkness, as on the polar slopes of Earth, where cold and night come on together. Gethin has a bright winter, bitter, terrible, and bright. We were 3 days getting through Tauranpath Forest. On the last, Estevan stopped and made camp early in order to set traps. He wanted to catch some pesthri. They are one of the larger land animals of winter, about the size of a fox, oviparous vegetarians with a splendid coat of gray or white fur. He was after the meat, for pesthri are edible. They were migrating south in vast numbers. They are so light-footed and solitary that we saw only two or three as we hauled, but the snow was thick-starred in every glade of the Thor forest, with countless little snowshoe tracks all heading south. Estevan's snares were full in an hour or two. He cleaned and cut up the 6 beasts, hung some of the meat to freeze, stewed some for our meal that night. Gethinians are not a hunting people, because there's very little to hunt. No large herbivores, thus no large carnivores, except in the teeming seas. They fish and farm. I had never before seen a Gethinian with blood on his hands. Estevan looked at the white pelts. There's a week's room and board for a pesthri hunter, he said. Gone to waste. He held out one for me to touch. The fur was so soft and deep that you could not be certain when your hand began to feel it. Our sleeping bags, coats, and hoods were lined with that same fur, an unsurpassed insulator and very beautiful to see. Hardly seems worth it, I said, for a stew. Estevan gave me his brief, dark stare and said, "We need protein," and tossed away the pelts where, overnight, the russi, the fierce little rat snakes, would devour them, and the entrails and the bones, and lick clean the bloody snow. He was right. He was generally right. There was a pound or two of edible meat on a pesthri. I ate my half of the stew that night and could have eaten his without noticing. Next morning, when we started up into the mountains, I was twice the sledge engine I had been. We went up that day. The beneficent snowfall and croxet, windless weather, 0 degrees Fahrenheit and 20 degrees, that had seen us through Tauranpath and out of range of probable pursuit, now dissolved wretchedly into above-freezing temperatures and rain. Now I began to understand why Gethinians complain when the temperature rises in winter and cheer up when it falls. In a city, rain is an inconvenience. To a traveler, it is a catastrophe. We hauled that sledge up the flanks of the Sambenchans all morning through a deep, cold porridge of rain-sodden snow. By afternoon, on steep slopes, the snow was mostly gone. Torrents of rain, miles of mud and gravel. We cased the runners, putting the wheels on the sledge, and hauled on up. As a wheeled cart, it was a bitch, sticking and tipping every moment. Dark fell before we found any shelter of cliff or cave to set up the tent in, so that despite all our care, things got wet. Estevan had said that a tent such as ours would house us pretty comfortably in any weather at all, so long as we kept it dry inside. Once you can't dry out your bags, you lose too much body heat all night, and you don't sleep well. Our food ration's too short to allow us to afford that. We can't count on any sunlight to dry things out, so we must not get them wet. I had listened, and had been as scrupulous as he about keeping snow and wet out of the tent, so that there was only the unavoidable moisture from our cooking and our lungs and pores to be evaporated. But this night everything was wet through before we could get the tent up. We huddled steaming over the chabi stove, and presently had a stew of pestri meat to eat, hot and solid, good enough almost to compensate for everything else. The sledge meter, ignoring the hard uphill work we had done all day, said we had come only 9 miles. "First day we've done less than our stint," I said. Estevan nodded and neatly cracked a leg bone for the marrow. He had stripped off his wet outer clothes and sat in shirt and breeches, barefoot, collar open. I was still too cold to take off my coat and yeb and boots. There he sat, cracking marrow bones, neat, tough, durable, his sleek, fur-like hair shedding the water like a bird's feathers. He dripped a little onto his shoulders, like house eaves dripping, and never noticed it. He was not discouraged. He belonged here. The first meat ration had given me some intestinal cramps, and that night they got severe. I lay awake in the soggy darkness, loud with rain. At breakfast, he said, "You had a bad night." "How did you know?" For he slept very deeply, scarcely moving, even when I left the tent. He gave me that look again. "What's wrong?" "Diarrhea." He winced and said savagely, "It's the meat." "I suppose so." "My fault. I should..." "It's all right." "Can you travel?" "Yes." Rain fell and fell. A west wind off the sea kept the temperature in the 30s, even here at 3,000 or 4,000 feet of altitude. We never saw more than a quarter mile ahead through the gray mist and mass of rain. What slopes rose on above us, I never looked up to see. Nothing to see but rain falling. We went by compass, keeping as much to northward as the cut and veer of the great slopes allowed. The glacier had been over these mountainsides in the hundreds of thousands of years it had been grinding back and forth across the north. There were tracks scored along granite slopes, long and straight, as if cut with a great U-gouge. We could pull the sledge along those scratches sometimes, as if along a road. I did best pulling. I could lean into the harness, and the work kept me warm. When we stopped for a bite of food at midday, I felt sick and cold and could not eat. We went on, climbing again now. Rain fell and fell and fell. Estevan stopped us under a great overhang of black rock along in mid-afternoon. He had the tent up almost before I was out of harness. He ordered me to go in and lie down. "I'm all right," I said. "You're not," he said. "Go on." I obeyed, but I resented his tone. When he came into the tent with our night's needs, I sat up to cook, it being my turn. He told me in the same peremptory tone to lie still. "You needn't order me about," I said. "I'm sorry," he said inflexibly, his back turned. "I'm not sick, you know." "No, I didn't know." "If you won't say, frankly, I must go by your looks. You haven't recovered your strength, and the going has been hard. I don't know where your limits lie." "I'll tell you when I reach them." I was galled by his patronizing. He was a head shorter than I, and built more like a woman than a man, more fat than muscle. When we hauled together, I had to shorten my pace to his, hold in my strength, so as not to outpull him. A stallion and harness with a mule. "You're no longer ill, then?" "No, of course I'm tired. So are you." "Yes, I am," he said. "I was anxious about you. We have a long way to go." He had not meant to patronize. He had thought me sick, and sick men take orders. He was frank, and expected a reciprocal frankness that I might not be able to supply. He, after all, had no standards of manliness, of virility, to complicate his pride. On the other hand, if he could lower all his standards of Shikrathor, as I realized he had done with me, perhaps I could dispense with the more competitive elements of my masculine self-respect, which he certainly understood as little as I understood Shikrathor. How much of it did we cover today? He looked around and smiled a little gently. 6 miles, he said. The next day we did 7 miles, the next day 12, and the day after that we came out of the rain, out of the clouds, and out of the regions of mankind. It was the 9th day of our journey. We were 5,000 to 6,000 feet above sea level now, on a high plateau full of the evidences of recent mountain building and volcanism. We were in the fire hills of the Sembenshin Range. The plateau narrowed gradually to a valley, and the valley to a pass between long ridges. As we approached the end of the pass, the rain clouds were thinning and rending. A cold north wind dispersed them utterly, laying bare the peaks above the ridges to our right and left, basalt and snow, piebald and patchwork of black and white, brilliant under the sudden sun in a dazzling sky. Ahead of us, cleared and revealed by the same vast sweep of the wind, lay twisted valleys hundreds of feet below, full of ice and boulders. Across those valleys, a great wall stood, a wall of ice, and raising our eyes up and still up to the rim of the wall, we saw the ice itself, the Gobrin Glacier, blinding and horizonless to the utmost north, a white the eyes could not look on. Here and there, out of the valleys full of rubble and out of the cliffs and bends and masses of the great ice field's edge, black ridges rose. One great mass loomed up out of the plateau to the height of the gateway peaks we stood between, and from its side drifted heavily a mile-long wisp of smoke. Farther off there were others, peaks, pinnacles, black cinder cones on the glacier. Smoke panted from fiery mouths that opened out of the ice. Estravan stood there in harness beside me, looking at that magnificent and unspeakable desolation. "I'm glad I have lived to see this," he said. I felt as he did. It is good to have an end to journey towards, but it is the journey that matters in the end. It had not rained here on these north-facing slopes. Snowfields stretched down from the pass into the valleys of moraine. We stowed the wheels, uncapped the sledge runners, put on our skis, and took off, down, north, onward, into that silent vastness of fire and ice that said in enormous letters of black and white, "Death. Death." Written right across the continent. The sledge pulled like a feather, and we laughed with joy.